You know, when we first moved to Alabama, I grew up in Idaho. Went to K-State for my undergraduate work and did some artificial, graduate work also in artificial intelligence there. Then went into the Air Force and started pilot training and eventually got stationed in Montgomery, Alabama. And when I came to Alabama, I was totally ignorant about life in Alabama. And we helped, the Lord helped through us. We started Eastwood Presbyterian Church and absolutely loved the people there. Still some of our dearest friends are from Montgomery, Alabama, and God blessed the church. We had such a sweet, sweet fellowship, but what my wife and I didn't understand was that one week in the fall, all of a sudden, people started to hate each other and started wishing evil on each other in our sweet little fellowship, and I couldn't quite understand what was going on, so after a few years, we began to recognize what was happening here, so we learned, you know, very quickly that having an AU on your hat doesn't always get you friends. Just ask for grace. For those of you who wear a different hat in the fall. But I want to say again this to you, especially for those of you who are part of the flock here, to encourage you to pray for your pastor for the session. It has been a delight to be able to be here, Pastor Reeder and his and Bruce and Eric, and it's everyone has been so wonderful to us, and we thank you for that. However, of course, they assigned me the task of speaking tonight on the age of the earth. Lucky me. That's what we're going to attack here tonight, if we can make this make this work. Now, I will tell you though, I'm not too thrilled with that title, the Age of the Earth, and I'll tell you why. I'm going to submit to you the better title for us to look at tonight is the Earth's True History. Because what's most important here is not so much the age as it is the view of the history of the earth. So, I don't know, Sally, are you here? Is Sally here tonight? Okay, so there's a young woman who's, I think 16 or 17 years old. I was going to embarrass her, but, she's not here to do that. What's important about Sally is not her age. What's important about Sally is her history. What's important about me is not my age. What's important about me is my history. And the same is true for you. Just saying that someone is 45 years old doesn't tell me much. But to know where they're born, to know what they believe, to know the experiences that they've been through, the events of their life, the deaths, the tragedies, all of those things. That's what is important about understanding who someone is. And so I would just submit to you that the simple question that is often asked, well, what do you think the age of the earth is? Really should be responded more by saying, what do you think the true history of the earth is? Does that make sense? Is that fair? And so that's how we'll proceed. Now, of course, if I learn the history, of Eric Ribbles, and I find out when he was born, it's not too difficult to then calculate his age. And that's what we'll do tonight. We'll talk about what are the two different views of history of the earth, and then that will derive for us an understanding of the age that is understood from both of those histories. So what I'd like to do, if you'll allow me to, I thought, because we did see the movie here, I'll do a little backstage with you of the movie. But then I want to talk about the history of science. I'll do that quickly because we've already addressed that in the conference so far. I want to deal a little bit with the four different views. That's very, very critical. And if you're going to understand how the history of the earth is viewed, we need to understand those four major views of origin and the views of Genesis. And then we'll look at the two views of earth history. And if we have time, I may take you backstage a little bit, and then we'll do Q&A. So that's our evening here. So just a very quick backstage. I think some of you I've talked to you a little bit about. If you happen to see the movie again, God was gracious throughout the filming of Is Genesis History. Thomas and I have talked about this multiple times, how many, many places during this documentary it was absolutely clear that God's hand was on this. One of the places was at the Memphis Zoo, where for example, the panda is very seldom do you even get to see a panda. When we, Todd Wood and I arrived there and we got the crew there and we were going to film in front of the panda exhibit area, this panda came out and sat down right next to us, leaned up against the plexiglass that far away from us and stayed there the whole time we filmed. And then we wanted to film in front of the gorilla era, talking about, of course, the evolutionary theory and genetics and so forth. And lo and behold, as we sat up and got ready to film, this silverback gorilla came and sat down right between us, right in the frame. I mean, it was just like somebody had given him a cue and said, "This is, you need to sit right here." And he came and he sat down right there between us and began to eat while we're talking. I said, "This is the most incredible thing in the world." Now, the problem was, in the middle of the filming, the gorilla threw up. And what was worse is that after we recovered and got started again, then he started eating it. And then he threw up again, and he did that three times. And so Todd and I, and if you've ever gotten to that point where you get so tickled that you can't, you know, you try to stop and you say, okay, I'm fine. Then you look at each other and you break. And so there were a lot of those moments in the film. Well, let's deal first of all with the history of science. We've already talked about this a little bit in some of our other sessions, but I think it's important to summarize it again and call your attention to a really important book in understanding all of this from Thomas Kuhn. The Rise and Fall of Scientific Paradigms, and in that he chronicles, as you can see there on this little graph, how scientific paradigms have arisen and they have fallen. When they arise, they rule, they reign. Our thinking is bound up within the framework of that scientific paradigm. In many cases, people who think out of that box are either shunned. In our case today, they're not allowed to publish. And so that way the scientific paradigm has control over scientific investigation and scientific conclusions and today publishing. But those paradigms then collapse under the weight of contradictory observations that come in, and eventually they collapse and are replaced by another paradigm. And so the current paradigm needs to be seen in that light. My personal view, I mentioned this to you in another session, my personal view is that the current paradigm is at risk of collapsing, and that's not new. All the others have collapsed, and that collapse will occur as a result of the current paradigm being tied to naturalism and saying that everything came about as through random processes. But as we look deeper and deeper into the cell, for example, and we see the incredible complexity there, that those are the kinds of things that cause a paradigm to collapse. We talked the other night about what might replace that, and I think it could well be a replacement of an agreement that there is some alien force that seeded life and possibly had some direction on it. We're ripe for that, as you know, in the entertainment world. I call this spiritual naturalism. Naturalism, recall, is a philosophy in which all of the world is viewed as simply a black box. And the only thing that exists within that black box, all of reality, the traditional naturalism, is that all that exists is matter and energy. But we, in our culture today, are increasingly adding a third element into this box. Don't be confused by it, because they add spirituality as a third element. Matter, energy, spirituality. But don't be confused, because that's not a transcendent spirituality. It is a natural spirituality. Some, like as in the force be with you. So in the force be with you in Star Wars, it's not a transcendent force. It's simply a natural force within the natural realm. And it's possible that a new paradigm will arise in which that will be recognized. And so there might be something spiritually within the natural realm that somehow, whether it's an alien force, that provides that design. But we can't continue close our eyes and ears from the current scientific paradigm to the vast complexity, the exquisite nature of the things that we find within, for example, the human cell. So the current paradigm is married to naturalism, which is very, very different from the paradigm before this, represented by Kepler in his statement that the chief end and aim of all investigations of the eternal world should be to discover the rational order and harmony which has been imposed upon it by God. And that assumes then that there is a God, a transcendent God, an eminent God, a God who is not only creator, but he has created a universe in which he has imposed, as we read in Romans 1, and we can even see his nature as a result of his handiwork. But that, of course, has now changed with the new paradigm, and it's wedded to naturalism, and so the mandatory thing of the new paradigm is that nothing is allowed to point to anything outside the box. So no matter how powerful, no matter how strong the evidence is, that evidence cannot and will not ever point to a transcendent cause. Ever. It cannot. It's not allowed to. That's what the current paradigm has placed boundaries upon. So we see this, for example, George Wald. George Wald is a Nobel Prize winner. I think it was in study of the retina. I think something like that. A scientist. And just look at one of his statements here, several of his statements that give you some clarity into this kind of thinking in the current paradigm. Most modern biologists, having reviewed with satisfaction the downfall of the spontaneous generation hypothesis. So what is he saying? The downfall of the spontaneous generation hypothesis. Spontaneous generation is the hypothesis that life arrives from non-life. spontaneous generation, life from non-life. And so he's saying most modern biologists, having reviewed with satisfaction, so, okay, we agree, the downfall of spontaneous generation hypothesis, yet unwilling to accept the alternative belief in special creation, are left with nothing. I think a scientist has no choice but to approach the origin of life through a hypothesis of spontaneous generation. Now, here's a very clear indication of an individual who's caught up and bound up in a scientific paradigm which is wedded to naturalism, and to say it is the spontaneous generation hypothesis can't be true, but the alternative is to accept special creation, so we have to accept spontaneous generation. So one only has to contemplate the magnitude of this task, to concede spontaneous generation of a living organism is impossible. Yet here we are, as a result, I believe in spontaneous generation. He believes in that which he says is impossible. Why? Because the conclusion can never point to anything outside of the box. So it had to happen, even though he says it is impossible. This is what happened with Francis Crick. I think I addressed this in a Q&A the other night. So Francis Crick, remember, is a co-discoverer of DNA. In examining now the workings of the inner cell, which was a black box to Darwin, now we begin to look at it, and Francis Crick and Watson discovering now this amazing reality that the human cell contains this long and complex set, not only of information, but of codes and instructions, like software, fully formed, fully debugged. And Crick is now looking at all of this, but just like George Wald, Crick cannot accept that this was the result of a creator God. So, but he recognizes this, the complexity. He says, an honest man armed with all of the knowledge available to us now could only state that in some sense the origin of life appears at the moment to be almost a miracle. So many are the conditions which would have had to have been satisfied to get it going. And so instead of turning to the Creator God, Francis Crick then came up with his famous panspermia theory, directed panspermia, the theory that the first living cell must have been transported by to Earth from some other planet outside of our solar system. And of course, the silliness of this is that Francis Crick has merely just put the problem off somewhere else. But he has to do this. Francis Crick has to do this. Even though he now has made the box a little bigger by including alien forces, but that's what the box was that size anyway, because the box was all of natural reality, which included planets and all those aliens out there, which must be out there. That's why we're so desperate to find life in outer space. And so Francis Crick, instead of turning to the Creator God, turns to some strange hypothesis. It has absolutely no evidence to support it, but it is consistent with with the paradigm and with the boundaries of his paradigm. And that, again, is why I am always perplexed, and I don't mean this to be offensive to those of you in this position, but I honestly ask you this question. How in the world can we, as a Christian, accept the conclusions from such a bounded paradigm? If the paradigm stands up and says, guess what? Life arose from natural processes. You should say in your mind, you had to say that. No matter what the evidence is, you had to say that. You had to come up with a theory that it was a result of natural causes. And so I just caution you, if you are the mindset to believe the current paradigm so strongly that it somehow has the ability to honestly view the evidence and give a right conclusion, I just call your mind to what we're looking at here. That it does not. It's bounded. And again, remember, we're not talking about all of science. There's a confusion there. There's operational science, you know, there's laboratory science, and there's historical science. And operational science, that's what brings us all of the wonderful, although sometimes I don't think it's so wonderful, but we have all of these amazing things that operational science has given to us, and engineering is part of all this. Laboratory science, and those kinds of things but history science I often view as philosophical science. And it's a small part of that historical science that we have the issue with. When they begin to answer philosophical questions of what's the origin, where do we come from, and by inference, the meaning of life, and that is where I have a difference of opinion. Don't let people say that, oh, you Christians, you're just anti-science. We're not anti-science. Not at all. But we have a difference of opinion with a science that makes a conclusion that cannot be tested in the lab at all. All right, so I'm waxing too long. This is a very, I want to just spend a minute here because one of the things that did not make the film was an interview that we did with a microbiologist at Lipscomb University in Tennessee. And he is doing cancer research. And one of the things that they were discovering at the time we interviewed them was something that Francis Crick was confused about. And his confusion came from the standpoint that Crick and Watson realized when they looked at the DNA and how it worked that the DNA strands, as we know, this helix, that the DNA strand had to somehow be pulled apart in order for the mechanisms to get in and read the code. But in Francis Crick's mind, he's thinking of pulling this thing apart from one end, and it's extremely long. And if you pull it apart long enough to finally get down to the set of code that is needed down there, then you would have super coiling in the rest of the DNA as all of those coils get compressed into a smaller and smaller space, kind of like a telephone cord that gets coiled up. And if you're too young, ask your parents about the telephone cord. So what we have found now, and he is describing this to us, he said, here's what we have discovered. We've discovered what Francis Crick knew had to happen. He knew it worked, but he just didn't know how. And he said, now we know how it happens. And it happens as a result of this little machine called the topoisomerase. And so he began to describe what this machine is. He said, so let's suppose that the cell is in need of a new carburetor. We'll say a new carburetor. And the instruction set for the carburetor is down at mile 362 in the DNA. Well, somehow, the cell, knowing it needs a new carburetor, somehow, all of a sudden, this little machine comes flying in called the topoisomerase. It goes down exactly to where that instruction set starts in the DNA. He clips the DNA at the start of the instruction set. He clips it at the bottom of that instruction set, and then he unwinds the DNA while these machines come in and replicate the code. And then he waits until the carburetor looks good, then he winds it up the right number of turns, slips it back into the DNA, welds the top and bottom, and then he goes off. I said, you got to be kidding me. I mean, this is real? He said, yeah, it's an amazing thing, and we're thinking in cancer research if we can somehow interrupt the topoisomerase in the cancer cells, and we could stop it from growing. And I said, well, is this common knowledge? I mean, do people? I said, oh yeah, microbiologists, we know all this. And I said, what are they saying? And they say, well, that pretty much is, you know, the same thing that microbiology has been saying for a long time. And they say, well, that's really remarkable, isn't it? You know, look what random processes have produced. This is simply a subset of a logical map associated with with DNA replication and the work of the topoisomerase. I know it's of course you can't understand all of that. I mean, look at the complexity of this. And we're adding more and more complexity as to what is really going on here and how all of this fits together. When I was doing my computer science degree, and I was doing my master's work in artificial intelligence, that time, the holy grail in computer science and artificial intelligence was to discover and create the perfect random number generator. And there are a lot of reasons for that we needed to have a true random number generator. The problem was that any time we built a software system to produce random numbers, it began to replicate itself at a certain point. It began to repeat itself. And as soon as it began to repeat itself, then it was a pattern and it wasn't truly random. So you can look at that and you can say, well, okay, that looks like random numbers. So look at this. Does anything all of a sudden jump out at you? Well, of course it does. You see a pattern there. And as soon as you see a pattern, the simplest of patterns, a diagonal set of ones in those numbers, you know, we know, computer scientists know, that's not a true random generator. It was not created by a random process. And yet here we are thinking that, if you look at this, exquisite patterns, more than just patterns, is all created by random processes. This is insane. Absolutely insane. It cannot be produced by a random process because, by definition, it's not random if it produces the patterns. And I'm not yelling at you. I get excited about this. So nothing is allowed to point to anything outside of the box, no matter how powerful the evidence is. No matter how compelling the evidence is, it cannot point to anything but a random, natural process cause. It has to. And that then requires, if it's a random process, that requires deep time. And I mean deep time in order for anyone to begin to believe that random processes over deep, deep time could have eventually produced all of this complexity. So time becomes the key issue. And why we're addressing the issue tonight of the true history of the earth and therefore the age of the earth. The current paradigm demands deep time. Why do you suppose it demands deep time? Every one of you can answer that. It has to have deep time. Because if you have a short period of time, what are you faced with? A miracle. George Waldegan. Time is the hero of the plot. What we regard as impossible on the basis of human experience is meaningless here. Given so much time, the impossible becomes possible. Do you understand the magic wand of deep time? It's kind of like the national debt. At some point, the numbers get fuzzy. It's like us thinking of God's infiniteness, of His eternality. In our finite minds, we try to think about this, and at some point in thinking about the infinite eternality of God, our mind turns to mush. And I think the same thing happens here. Our mind must turn to mush in order for us to think that random processes can do this, just given enough time. Can a boulder stand up and sing Happy Days Are Here Again? Someone would think you're crazy if you said, I think this boulder can stand up and sing Happy Days Are Here Again. If you say, well, that's stupid. If you're thinking in near time. But if you think in deep time, sure it can. In fact, that's what the theory says. That's what the theory says. That eventually the boulder stands up and sings Happy Days Are Here Again, given enough time. Naturally, over a long period of time, given so much time, the impossible becomes possible. If it's near time, it's a miracle. Do you remember what Jesus said? When the folks came and said, you need to tell, Jesus is coming into Jerusalem. Palm Sunday, we call it. And they're singing Hosanna. And the leaders come to you, you need to tell these people to shut up. And Jesus says, hey, I tell you, if these were silent, the very stones would cry out. Do you think if the people had been silent, the stones would have cried out? Absolutely they would. The boulders would have sang, Happy Days Are Here. And it would have been a miracle. Okay, quickly, four views regarding origins and Genesis. The first one, commonly called atheistic evolution, I prefer to call it secular evolution because there are people there who are not truly atheists. It's a secular view of evolution. God is not in the picture. There is the second view, commonly called theistic evolution. I explained to you at an earlier session why I don't like theistic evolution, because the theistic evolutionist doesn't really think that God had anything to do with this process, that it was all random. And so I think it's better to refer to that position as deistic evolution. There is a third position, commonly called old earth creationists. I think it's better labeled deep time creationists. And then there is a fourth view, often called young earth creationists. I don't like that term at all. And I'll tell you why, because I will stand here and tell you, I do not believe that the earth is young. Look at me. Am I young? you guys are so kind. You know, I don't want to say he's old. I'm old. Thousands of years is old. This position is better labeled historic creation. Why? Because it holds to the historic narrative of the creation text. Okay, so if we look at these four views, they lay out this way, and that is the first are committed. These first two on the left, I don't know if you can see the dotted line there, but the first two on the left are committed to evolutionary theory. First, they're committed to the evolutionary theory first. The first three are committed to deep time first. A priori, deep time first. The fourth is committed first to, this is out of order, committed first to the text, the narrative
the historical narrative of the text, committed to that first. That leads to a commitment to near time. And so the first three are then forced, although actually the first one, the secular evolutionist doesn't care about Genesis. The second does care because there are believers in the second one, and so they must come to the text, and they must therefore, and we talked about this yesterday, they therefore must declare that text to be some other genre other than historical narrative. Declare it to be poetic or allegory or myth or some other genre. And once you do that, as we said yesterday, you then liquefy the text and you can then make it what you want. And so the first three views then have to approach the Genesis account from something other than historical narrative in order to conform it to their a priori position, either to evolution or to deep time. Okay, so now let's talk about Earth's history and the two views. How did it get to be 1840 or 645? I'm already done. All right, so we'll do this quickly. Two views of Earth history. Thomas Purefoy, I borrowed his, and I know this is very small up here, but I know you all have photographic memories and you remember his presentation on Sunday. But the first two are graphic representations of the history of the universe and the history of the Earth in terms of deep time and that long evolutionary process that was underway. And then as Earth came into being, we have this long evolutionary process in which the first cell becomes a living cell that grows in complexity over a period of a number of millions of years until we come to the present time. You contrast that with the history of the Earth as we discover it given to us in the text, and that the history of the Earth as God has given it to it is radically different than the history of the scientific paradigm. The scientific paradigm history is bound up primarily in the cause and effect of material. The history of the Earth in God's narrative is bound up primarily in God's creation and providence and man's response to God's actions. And in essence, God's meta-narrative. This is from Isaiah 44. Thus says the Lord, your Redeemer, who formed you from the womb. I am the Lord who made all things, who alone stretched out the heavens, who spread out the earth by myself, who frustrates the signs of liars and makes fools of diviners, who turns wise men back and makes their knowledge foolish, who confirms the word of his servant and fulfills the counsel of his messengers, who says of Jerusalem, she shall be inhabited, and of the cities of Judah, they shall be built, and I will raise up their ruins, who says to the deep, be dry, and I will dry up your rivers. Who says to Cyrus, he is my shepherd, and he shall fulfill all my purpose, saying to Jerusalem, she shall be built, and of the temple your foundation shall be laid. This is the author of history. This is the providential God who not only created all things, but he is providentially involved imminently within his creation, and he is the one who declares to Cyrus, do this and do that. And that is the history that we find in the text. And it's radically different than the history that comes from the scientific paradigm. And it primarily deals, as we were saying the other day, in the Old Testament, with the seed line and the war between the seed line, the coming of Christ, and eventually the coming of the restoration of all things. So, quickly, the current scientific paradigm builds its dating by first of all looking at what is considered to be and commonly called the fossil record, or the column of the rocks, and the fossils that are found within those rocks. At the very lower level, there are no fossils. And then as you move up in the fossil record, and this is a fairly good representation of how those layers are laid out. We tried to address that in the film. And then to the left are the numbers of the millions of years which are associated with each of those layers. Primarily for a long time, those layers were achieved through various means and then radiometric dating. I should have added to the right there also the dating associated in terms of the universe, starlight. But if we're dealing with Earth's history, it comes from the rocks and it comes from the radiometric dating of those rocks. So here are the three assumptions associated with radiometric dating, because that's a key element. That's the clock that is used primarily to determine the dates that you see from the current paradigm. And here are these assumptions. You have to begin with some initial condition, and oftentimes what that means is the amount of the parent material. You know, whether we're talking about carbon, we're talking about argon, lead, the lead potassium. These are unstable elements that are found within the parent. They decay over a period of time. That's the second assumption. There is a decay rate associated with those elements. And that decay rate, the assumption is the decay rate is consistent over time. And the third primary assumption is that it is a closed system. And so we often think of these things, and one way to represent how this works is through this timepiece. Now, so what we do is we say, okay, the initial conditions, if you were to examine this, you would want to know how many grains of sand were in the top bowl. You would want to know at what rate the sand is running through the narrow part of this machine. And you would then want to know how much material has gone through there. And supposedly, if you did this correctly, you would be able to determine how long the sand has been running through this mechanism. But what you don't know is what the initial conditions are. You don't know if behind the curtain back there, I actually had this sitting level. That would change, would it not, your understanding of how long the sand has been running through there. And you do not know also if actually I flipped it over before I brought it out here. Would that change your calculation? And what if we then also said, well, let's make this top globe open. It's a funnel. It's absolutely open. And let's make the bottom open. And the sand now is going out on the floor. And then every once in a while, we'll have a miner come in and shovel more sand into the top. And every once in a while, we have a miner come in and shovel sand out of the bottom. How does that affect your understanding of determining how long the sand has been? It changes it. And that's one of the problems associated with radiometric dating. We don't know if it's a closed system. We don't really know the initial amount of parent material. We don't know if something has changed. So we're then left as we have completely run out of time here with a look at the biblical dating of the earth. And because the history that we have been given of the earth in the scripture is so much based upon people and the genealogies of people, and we're given some fairly good information. So if we start with 7 days, we start with an Adam. The Adam, and Adam then had a son, and the text then tells us that when Adam was 130 years old, he fathered a son in his own likeness after his image and named him Seth. And so we have 130 years, and we then have Seth. In the same way, the text tells us, as we look at each of these sons, when the father had the son. And so it's relatively easy to calculate. There are a few places where we don't have those perfect dates, and some may rightly say, well, maybe there are some skipped generations, and that may be possible, but it doesn't really change the overall number. So at this point, we could say from creation to the flood is about 1,700 years. If you then, in the same way, follow genealogies, and then you follow other now human records in history of when things occurred, matching up with the scripture, the flood to the Exodus, as the children of Israel and God brought them out of Egypt, to the Exodus, from the flood to the Exodus is about 1,000 years. From the Exodus to the time when the kingdom was divided is about 500 years. From the divided kingdom to Christ is about another 1,000 years. And from the divided kingdom to the Birmingham Conference is about 2,000. And for sure, if we follow that faithfully, recognizing that there may be some places where there might be some extra generations here or there, in reality, they don't change it much. Where an approximate date is so different than the natural or the current paradigm. For sure, we're less than 10,000 years, which is extremely different than 3.8 million years or something like that in terms of the natural paradigm's understanding.